This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your bird on a wire of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Garamonica.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows that the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich.
It's been dark days in pop music the last couple weeks for a variety of reasons. Most loudly, we've lost a couple of real heavy hitters. I've got John Pareles, chief pop music critic of the New York Times.
Hey, John.
And we were just listening to Everybody Knows.
By Leonard Cohen.
Who
was such a great loss.
Who, about a week ago, died in his sleep. And we're going to be talking about Leonard Cohen today. We're going to be talking about Mose Allison. And we're also going to be talking about Leon Russell. It's been a very, very dark week. But we're going to start with Leonard Cohen. And JP, you've interviewed Leonard a couple times. You just showed me this 1995 story where I know you're going to talk about what he said, but I'm going to talk about what you said for a second, which is that you said he's the erudite's version or satisfies an erudite's needs for both a Barry White and a Julio Iglesias, which... That should be on, hopefully, my ideal Instagram bio would be that.
But actually, I think I also should have said, and Umberto Eco.
And, okay. So talk about Leonard Cohen, because you also wrote a very beautiful piece about his songwriting in the wake of his death. Talk about Leonard Cohen's songwriting and his voice and his songwriting, which and how they sort of operated together and or maybe at odds at times.
Well, I was wondering if he had a better voice. Would his songs have been different? If he had a prettier voice, would his songs have been different? Because he had to make words do so much of the heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he was young, when his voice was about an octave higher than it was by the end,
mm-hmm.
He sang in a deadpan.
Yes.
So his words had to really do all of the work. And so he made each one count. I always had the feeling of Leonard Cohen sitting there with a block of marble and a tiny chisel, just like... hitting very slowly until every word was perfect.
And he started as a poet.
He was a poet
before he was a songwriter.
Yeah,
a
poet and a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Judy Collins suggested, you know, why don't you write a song? And he followed through. He was very slow. Hallelujah, mm-hmm. the song that everybody has beaten to death, but is still a fabulous song. Hallelujah took him 5 years to write.
Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. Saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair. Then she broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah.
He talked about at one point banging his head on the floor of the Royalton Hotel because he was having such trouble with it. And apparently there are like page after page of verses. There's two very different versions of it. One is the sort of sexy Bible stories version where David's watching Bathsheba bathe naked, and the other has no biblical references at all and is all about sex and ecstasy and transcendence. Mm-hmm. The Jeff Buckley version, the John Cale version combine elements of both. Mm-hmm.
But that is sort of part of Cohen's, you know, his worldview encompasses both of those things.
Well, they were never separate for him. Right. I mean, they were both forms of transcendence, the erotic and the mystical. He spent a lot of time at a Zen monastery, disappeared from his career for a long time. He called himself a ladies' man, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but also I think it was true. This 1995 interview, I was looking at it after he died. I hadn't looked at it in 20 years. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking of this Zen asceticism, and I took him to a Japanese tea room, and he immediately informed me that, you know, he'd been to a steakhouse the night before, so I knew I'd done the wrong thing.
There's also a good detail in that piece where he's talking about what he learned from his Zen master or from the person he had apprenticed himself to, and he said what he learned was how to be a good drinker, how to distinguish between Courvoisier and Remy Martin.
Yeah, that sounds like a good teacher.
Yeah, Buddhism is lit, huh?
So we sat down, and he, in that fabulous low voice, he starts to recite to me a song that hadn't been recorded yet, A Thousand Kisses Deep, which is an intensely romantic song. And the tables were close to each other, and this woman at the next table, you could see her head sort of, first she was like tilting her head, and then it was like a full swivel, and she was just like watching rapt as these verses came out of this incredibly dapper gentleman's mm-hmm. mouth. She asked him if it was published. She asked him what he did. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm a songwriter. She said, what kind of music? And he paused and he thought and he said, ballads.
That's one way of looking at him.
But he had her fully seduced, and mm-hmm. rightly so, because, I mean, if you recited this poem to a prospective lover and it was yours, who could resist you?
Can you tell me a little bit about that sort of the first wave Leonard Cohen stuff when he's just kind of sort of entering the folk world and kind of at that time, I guess, like right now, if there was a poet who started writing pop songs, we'd probably all arch our eyebrows and go, please don't. But at that time, I feel
wouldn't
like
he be a rapper if he was a poet writing pop songs?
I suppose. But even if they were a rapper, I'd still kind of like, you know, we'd still kind of be like, please don't at this point. Back then, the commingling was very different. So can you talk a little bit of that era, like sort of like 1.0 Leonard Cohen musician?
Well, I mean, the 60s were, in some ways, rock proving it was good enough to be literature. Mm-hmm. And Dylan was, there's some early Cohen that sounds like, I'm trying to write a Bob Dylan song. There's no question mm-hmm. about it. He found his voice very early as this somber, erotic, mystical guy, but Dylan lingers. I mean, songs like Suzanne, it starts out talking about a romance, and it has a verse about Jesus.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you want to be there.
Or songs like So Long, Mary Ann, which is a great fond lover's goodbye song, is a good pop song.
Now so long, Mary Ann, it's time we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all.
I mean, there's a reason that people like Judy Collins and others picked up on him. Those are good romantic pop songs. His voice was higher. His arrangements were more of an attempt to be ear-friendly. As he progressed, he got more and more laconic and more flinty and deeper but also funnier. His sense of humor comes out in all kinds of places. I mean, go back to Hallelujah. I mean, he rhymes Hallelujah, which is a religiously charged word. Mm. He rhymes it with "What's it do ya?"
Yeah.
I mean, there's always this playfulness, this like glint in his eye. Mm-hmm. A song like "Democracy Is Coming to the USA," or "First We Take Berlin." They're funny. They're brutal. They're dark. They're dystopian, but they're funny.
Was he a difficult fit for the sort of earnestness of that folk era?
No, I think he fit right into that mm-hmm. earnestness. There wasn't this sort of striving to be a pop star about him. Mm-hmm. It was more like these songs had to be chiseled and presented to the world. There was always a sobriety to him. You never had the feeling that he was he didn't want to be top of the pops.
Right.
He wanted to have his words and music heard. And the other thing I wanted to, I keep saying, is he was a musician too. I mean, despite having a voice that ended up very close to monotone, he wrote wonderful tunes. He wrote melodies, again, because I think his voice couldn't do, he couldn't make something pretty with his voice. He had to have a really rock-ribbed structure to get it across. But then, you know, you look at any Leonard Cohen quatrain, and my jaw drops with astonishment and admiration. He doesn't waste a word, and he can make a word pivot in meaning halfway through. I was listening to You Want It Darker, and I was actually trying to summarize it to write about it, and I could not tell if it is agnostic, blasphemous, or reverent. That song can be taken all three ways. He's very brilliant at finding the ambivalences of how we express ourselves.
When he was putting out music in the 80s, a thing that he seemed to do was be willing to adjust the musical approach and adjust what he was singing to and what he was writing from a musical perspective.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of, but I think a lot of songwriters and singers who sort of have their roots in the 60s and in that counterculture moment probably would have said synthesizers, but, you know, notwithstanding Dylan's electric stuff, but whatever. So here's Leonard Cohen in the mid 80s doing basically a wholly different kind of record.
I think it was good for him because it made his background, it made his backup more skeletal. And so his words could come out more. He was also really a chameleon in a way. I mean, he spent so much time in Europe. I remember seeing one show where I thought, he's gotten way too cabaret. He's trying to be Charles Aznavour. And I thought it was kind of cheesy. And then I saw him again X years later, and it was just right. He did hear really well.
Do you think part of that was about, especially in the later years, not that there's something cabaret about his voice, but because it approached that monotone, it almost could be caricaturish in a sense? Like it was, if you didn't buy in, it could be maybe a little bit caricaturish?
Not for me. For me, it was convincing. At times, he wrapped himself in too much sugar. He had these cooing backup vocals. But again, I think now looking back, there was always a kind of archness to it. There was always a little, I know I'm sugarcoating this, but you need it because if I said it straight, you just flee. But I mean, if you listen to some of the 80s stuff, it really, you could almost make a dance record out of it with a remix. Actually, why doesn't someone remix Leonard Cohen?
Take that up. That's a challenge we're putting out there. The Leonard Cohen remix challenge. It's your new mannequin challenge, people. Is there a Leonard Cohen period that speaks most loudly to you? Because I feel like there are distinct sonic periods. It's not, he's not working one style. He's working multiple styles.
Well, the words always come and get me anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I love his first album, which is pretty much a folk pop album.
Right.
I love his last album, which is this strange choirs and spooky blues things going on. I mean, You Want It Darker, he's looking at God and he's looking at death. There's no camouflage there.
Did he ever go out of critical favor?
He made some albums where he was a little too sparse. Dear Heather, which sounds like demos. I'm sorry, it just does. So some of those people were critical about. I mean, he was up and down. Not every song was perfect, though. There was always a verse, if you read them, that just comes and grabs you. So, yeah, he went out of favor because people got used to him. You know, the great perverse paradox of his career, which is that his manager bankrupts him and he has to go out on the road and make all of his money back and starts recording again. I mean, to have that kind of calamity produce that kind of wonderful comeback, I mean, it's a paradox Leonard Cohen would appreciate.
So that's definitely why he had to go back out on the
road. Yeah, he talked about it.
Right, he talked about it.
I'm glad he did because it gave him a chance to save some of his old songs from their bad arrangements. I mean, if you listen to the original version of Hallelujah, which is rejected by Columbia, you can see it's this kind of cluttered, not so good. But by the time he gets to it, when he's an older man, it's a fantastic song. And he doesn't need Jeff Buckley's voice to sing it. It works on its own with the arrangement that he's thought about for 20 years.
Were you able to see him in any of the recent tours?
Yeah, I mean, I saw him at Barclays. I mean, this music does not belong in an arena. And yet you had him very calmly somberly, lengthily, going song by song, and it's the quietest I've ever heard an arena.
Mm-hmm.
It just, everybody was hanging on every word.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was so elegant and precise and quiet in his movements, people leaned in. And I'm sure it was strategic, but it was also a wonderful thing to behold. His pacing was very slow. But because it was so slow, your heartbeat slowed down, your attention perked up, you were waiting for something. And I mean, things get thrown at us so fast now. And he was leaning back and giving you time to contemplate, which is what he's done in a lot of his songs.
You spoke to him also in 2010, I believe.
Yeah.
Tell me how you perceived any differences between 95 and 2010.
Not that much. Mm-hmm. That was a sudden one. It was like he was doing, for his last few albums, he would come to some place like Joe's Pub and play it for the press and talk about it a little bit. And the publicist grabbed him by the elbow and said, you know, would you like to talk to Leonard Cohen privately?
Mm-hmm.
And yes.
Yes, sure.
So that was 20 minutes.
Always bring your recorder, kids.
Yeah.
Always have it on you.
Exactly. So that was like half an hour in a dressing room at Joe's Pub.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Leonard Cohen was none of us, myself included, speak in complete sentences and complete paragraphs. And you had the feeling that his mind was so organized. I mean, you could just put a tape recorder in front of him and he would talk. It would be, you could transcribe it and have it published. Mm-hmm. You did have the feeling that he thought about everything he said. He wasn't a babbler. He thought fast and he thought clearly. That second interview, for some reason, because he'd been putting out albums more frequently than he had in the decade before, I asked him about working fast and did he give himself a deadline, and we were talking. I was talking about how deadlines help a writer sometimes, and he said, "I have a deadline, death." mortality is, you know, I'm working against my mortality, and you know, again, my jaw dropped. But he was right; he knew it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wasn't young. One of the things he did, one of his, I'm sure it was a canned line, but he would come out at an arena and say, I remember I was a young man of 75.
Mm.
And, mm-hmm. you know, everybody would laugh, but, you know, he was in his late 70s then.
Was. Right.
He'd been thinking about mortality all of his songwriting career, mm-hmm. though, because you don't think about God and eternity without thinking about mortality. But later in his career, I mean, he really just looked down in the abyss and faced it.
All right, so let's listen to the title track of the last Leonard Cohen album, You Want It Darker.
Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker. Hey, nay, 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 nay. I'm ready, my lord.
Okay, so JP, I asked you in what order we should speak about the subjects of this week's podcast, and you said we should do Mose Allison after Leonard Cohen because they shared a certain flintiness. So Mose Allison is a jazz pianist and sort of a blues singer, active in the 60s, 70s. I mean, active
50s.
50s. Tell me a little bit about Mose Allison and why he's a logical follow from Leonard Cohen.
Well, yeah, I mean, he wasn't, obviously he doesn't have the profile Leonard Cohen did, except among jazz people who all know him and who all love him. And people like Elvis Costello love him. The reason I thought he was a good segue was he could throw shade. He could seriously throw shade, and he could do it. He could very easily twist a knife. He had that. Well, he was from Mississippi, and he never lost that sort of plain spokenness. Meanwhile, as a piano player, he was deep into bebop, so he had both his feet grounded in the blues, but he could do some pretty strange, interesting harmonic things on top of it. But when he sang, he was just. He could twist a knife. Your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime. If silence was golden, you couldn't raise a dime. I mean, you know, you should know about this, John Caramanica.
Well, let's listen to a little Your Mind is on Vacation. Let's listen to the bars, Mose Allison bars on Your Mind is on Vacation.
You quoting figures and dropping names. You telling stories about the dames. You over laughing when things ain't funny. You trying to sound like the big money. You know if talk was criminal, you'd lead a life of crime. Because your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime.
But that's blues singing. Like, yeah. This is blues singing. And were there other musicians in that era who were bridging that blues jazz bebop gap?
Well, probably some. The 50s, there were hipsters, white right. hipsters. I mean, the reason Mose Allison stands above them is he wasn't some guy from New York learning it and figuring it out. He was really, you felt the Mississippi in him all the time. It was something he grew up with and lived with. And you could hear it in his voice. You could hear it in his drawl.
Mm-hmm.
So he had the advantage of growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
There were satirical songwriters in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But Allison was also one of those guys that the Brits discovered in the 60s. John Mayall right, would sing his songs.
And sets a lot of those people in motion. Helps yeah. to set those people in motion.
Bonnie Raitt did a wonderful version of Everybody's Crying Mercy, which is another sort of... Everybody's crying mercy, but nobody knows the meaning of the word. Tough-minded, pithy, funny, precise.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word I was groping for, is precise, because that's what Leonard Cohen was, mm-hmm. and that's what Mose Allison was, too. They nailed it. They had the exact word, and they did it in that extremely economical form.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any bridge between Mose Allison and Leon Russell?
Sure, the down-homeness.
Yeah.
Because Leon Russell, Oklahoma... They were both great piano players.
Mm-hmm.
They both had those serious southwestern roots. They heard that gospel. They heard those blues. It was the soil they stood on when they were young. So yeah, there's definitely a bridge. Leon Russell, what a strange life.
Mm-hmm.
He could play in Oklahoma clubs, luckily, because Oklahoma was dry, so he could start there as a teenager
yep.
and he didn't have to be old enough to drink. No mm-hmm. Remy, no Courvoisier.
Right.
Then he goes out to California, and he's this amazing two-fisted
down-home
piano player. He can play anything.
Yeah.
He can play classical. He can play jazz. He can play blues.
And he's playing on a lot of the big pop hits of the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who else played with the Beach Boys and the Rolling Stones?
Mm-hmm.
He's on Phil Spector songs.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those... Wrecking Crew session guys of the early 60s in Los Angeles that just worked on everything. He's on the Monster Mash, you'll mm-hmm. be happy to know. But then he steps out and he's not this anonymous session guy wearing glasses, nerding out over his keys.
Mm-hmm.
He's this guy with hair down to his shoulders.
Yeah, luxurious.
He's got this voice that sounds like this yowling, scratching, bluesy thing, and he's a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes Delta Lady for Joe Cocker, which mm-hmm. I think is his real, breakthrough moment. I mean, Joe Cocker didn't grow up on the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
and then he's leading Mad Dogs and Englishmen, which is this great tale of 60s excess.
Mm-hmm.
Woman out the country, now I find. Soft and fertile nature, and all its desires to satisfy your longing for the warmth and tender shelter of my body. Oh, your mind, yes, your mind, Delta Lady.
Okay, so that was a little bit of Delta Lady, Joe Cocker's Delta Lady, written by Leon Russell.
There's all American there. I mean, I think Leon Russell, along the same lines as Willie Nelson and Ray Charles, who are these guys who just have it all, mm-hmm. who jazz, blues, country, right. all of America, at their fingertips in their voices.
But Leon Russell was not much of a star in his own right. He helped make a bunch of other stars, but he was not much of a star in his own right.
He even recorded
country music under another, like under a pseudonym. Like, he wasn't, his primary focus wasn't on his own fame, I guess is what
no.
I'm saying.
No, yeah, there you go. But he was a full-fledged star in the early 70s. He played at the concert for
Bangladesh. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing that crazy top hat and that long gray hair a lot in rock circa 1972, 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sort of pulled away from it. It wasn't for him. I still don't know quite why. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe the pressure was too much. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Do you think also, in some sense, the dominant sound started to move away from him? Because
the 70s were, I mean, we made it from sort of roots music to crazy progressive rock to disco and punk.
Right.
So the style did move away.
Because the thing that I was sort of struck when I was thinking about Leonard Cohen before doing this was that he made some moves, maybe not like full-fledged moves, but he was willing to like adjust a little bit to the times.
Yeah.
And then thinking about Leon Russell, and I think the times did not adjust to Leon Russell.
You're probably right. Because he went and played piano with a bluegrass group, which is nuts on the face of it, since mm-hmm. bluegrass groups don't have pianos. He did gospel. He stayed with so to speak roots music,
mm-hmm.
but that was what he was great at.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume he had extreme royalties on A Song for You.
Oh, one can only hope. I mean, you know, and there's a song that he wrote that, again, took on a life of its own, much larger than Leon Russell.
It's a song of a star.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm singing for all those people, and now I'm singing just for you.
Mm-hmm.
So he did tap into that experience.
Mm-hmm. And wrote Superstar.
Carpenters.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you can listen to that
Luther Vandross. I'm just saying. Very special song for me.
But part of it is that he had the jazz vocabulary to write songs like that.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of classical music in him too. So he wasn't just like a three-chord blues guy. He was really a sophisticated musician. But you'd listen to that cracked, weird voice and you'd think, you know, this guy just crawled out of the swamp.
Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe starting in the mid-2000s or late 2000s, you would see him touring a lot in New York. He would pop up quite a bit. And then obviously there was the Elton John record. Talk to me a little bit about like this sort of late wave Leon Russell.
Well, people kept trying to revive his career. I mean, Bruce Hornsby tried in the 1990s mm-hmm. and made a record that was, you could hear, it was just like striving so hard to be radio friendly. It broke your heart. And
shouts to Bruce Hornsby. That's what Bon Iver trying to do to Bruce Hornsby now.
Turn around is fair play. People really revered him who knew about him. Elton John always said early on, you know, I wanted to play like Leon Russell. And that same, that two-fisted, big-corded thing is from Leon Russell to Elton John directly, no doubt about it. So Elton John decided to pay his debt and sort of pulled him out of...
Yeah, like cold call. Isn't the story sort of like basically cold called him?
Yeah. Mm. And so instead of playing, you know, 200-seat clubs in the Southwest, suddenly he's touring with Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that album's really touching because you can hear Elton John just, thank you, Leon, mm-hmm. all the way through, you know, in every note. So they did that late period tour, and then Leon Russell went back on the road in the tour bus he bought
mm-hmm.
and toured some more.
It's interesting to think about both Leonard Cohen and Leon Russell, like late career revivals, touring late in life. I feel like a lot of our heroes sometimes tap out. They say they don't, you know, like, that's not how I want to spend my, that's how I spend my 30s, 40s, and 50s. It's not how I want to spend my 70s. Like, and here are two artists who decided to remain vital
and
engaged. Yeah, in public.
Well, I mean, the other thing is people sort of back off to raise families, and then they realize, you know, I kind of liked it when 10,000 people were screaming and shouting my name.
So they're just vain, is what you're saying.
No, they're not. I think, how could you turn down all that love? I talked to Bruce Springsteen about this. He said, you know, what's not to like, you know, about people yelling your name and applauding and pouring love on you?
Right.
So I take it. I don't know if I could maintain it, but I'd take it.
All right, so let's go out with a dedication, Lil Leon Russell, the original song for you.
I've been so many places in my life and time. I've sung a lot of songs, I've made some bad rhymes. I've acted out my love in stages with 10,000 people watching. But we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thanks to my guest, John Pareles. I would also like to acknowledge the passing in the past week of David Mancuso, founder of The Loft, very important figure in disco music. Mr. 3-2, the Houston rapper, member of Convicts and Black Monks. Very important in the development of that scene. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can read John Perellis writing about Leon Russell and Leonard Cohen at nytimes.com/music. Subscribe to us on Google Play, iTunes, wherever you get your audio content. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com and tell us how you're feeling. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we will be back next week.
But now I'm so much better, and if my words don't come together, listen to the melody, 'cause my love in their hiding.
Tillamook Chocolate Collection ice cream is a total chocolate game changer. We start with unbelievably creamy dark chocolate ice cream. Then we add different chocolate treats, like chocolate cookies, chocolate cake, or chocolate brownies, to make four decadent chocolate flavors. Because sometimes the thing that pairs best with chocolate is more chocolate. Tillamook Chocolate Collection Ice Cream. Extraordinary Dairy.